Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Now, this is the fifth episode on Thomas Jefferson, read from a Wikipedia article. I think last time my wife came home, I just had to look. And we're getting towards the end. Now, in the time since last, there's been a horrendous windstorm come through Australia up here. We've got different birds been blowing into the area. We've got these beautiful whipbirds going in, so you might hear them at the background. And of course, in this dreadful wind, it's blowing some of the sheets around the garden. So I just really hope I've got them all. And unfortunately, it's collected them. They get so disordered over time that I have to throw them out at the end. That's okay, but it just means that in future, when I get an article, I'm just going to number the pages 1, 2, 3, you know, by hand, because you can't do that afterwards. I might even bind them, because it's sort of hard, you know, you're in a treadmill reading them, studying them first, and then it's sort of hard to get your mind around it. So, with the proviso, this may be out of order, unfortunately. We'll just read through it. Now, we've just covered Lafayette's visit, and Lafayette visited him in Monticello just before he died. And now we come to appropriately to the final days, death and burial. I just note that you don't want burial, death, and then final days. The opposite wouldn't work so well. Jefferson's approximately $10,000 of debt weighed heavily on his mind in his final months. It became increasingly clear that he would have little to leave his heirs. On February 1826, he successfully applied to the General Assembly to hold a public lottery to fund for as a fundraiser. His health was his health began to deteriorate in July 1825 due to a combination of rheumatism from the arm and wrist injuries, which we don't know how he got, but assume he fell off his horse, as well as intestinal and urinary disorders. And by June the 26th, he was confined to bed. On the 3rd of July, Jefferson was overcome by fever and declined an invitation to Washington to attend an anniversary celebration of the Declaration, which would be July the 4th. During his last hours of his life, he was accompanied by his family members and friends. Jefferson died on July the 4th at 12:50 p.m. age 83, the same day of the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. His last recorded words were, "No doctor, nothing more," refusing laudanum from his position. But his final significant words were often cited as, "Is this the fourth? Or is this the fourth? Or is it the fourth? This is the fourth." John Adams died. His last words included an acknowledgement of his longtime friend and rival. Jefferson survives. Although Adams was unaware that Jefferson had died several hours before, the sitting president was Adams' son, Quincy Adams. Oh, wow. So you've got Bush and Bush Jr. And then you've got the Roosevelts. I think one was an uncle, Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt. It's pretty amazing how that goes on. So, when is it Trump? Oh, my godfather. Shortly after the Jefferson had died, attendants found a gold locket on a chain around his neck, where he had rested for 40 years, containing a small faded blue ribbon, which tied a lock of his wife's, Martha's, brown hair. Jefferson's remains were buried at Monticello. Underneath the epitaph, it wrote, He was buried, Jefferson, author of... He was buried, author of the Declaration of the American Independence, of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia. Well, there you go. In his advanced years, Jefferson became increasingly concerned that people understand the principles in and the people responsible for writing the Declaration of Independence. He was continuously defending himself as its author. He considered the document one of his greatest life achievements. In addition to authoring the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom and his founding of the University of Virginia, plainly absented himself from his epitaph were his political roles, including President of the United States of America. Disselin died deep in debt, unable to pass on his estate freely to his heirs. He gave instructions in his will for the disposal of his assets, including freeing Sally Helming's children, my God, but his estate, possessions of the slaves, are sold at public auction starting in 1827. In 1831, Monticello was sold to Martha Jefferson Randolph and other heirs. It's pretty interesting. It's Jefferson's political and social religious views. Unfortunately, this is good. I think I've got everything here. Jefferson subscribed to the political ideas expounded by John Locke, Francis Bacon, Isaac Newton, but whom he considered... Isaac Newton had political views. John Locke, I have to reread Francis Bacon. Fantastic. Great man. Whom he considered the three greatest men who ever lived. He was influenced by Gibbons, Hume, David Hume, which is problems of induction, stuff like that, Robinson, Bolingbroke, Montesquieu, and Voltaire. Voltaire is just the greatest person. I just have to reread him over and over again. Jefferson thought that the independent, yeoman, agrarian life were the ideals of republican virtues. He distrusted cities and finances, favoured decentralised governments' power, and believed in the tyranny that had plagued the common man in Europe was due to corrupt political establishments and monarchies. He supports the efforts to de-establish the British English Church, Church of England, wrote the Virginian Statute of Religious Freedom, and pressed for a wall of separation between church and state. The Republicans under Jefferson were strongly influenced by the 18th century Whig Party, which believed in limited government. His Democratic Republican Party had become dominant in the early American politics, with his views are known as Jeffersonian democracy. I find that interesting, doesn't it? Oh, well, it's interesting. I'm reading it. Of course, I'm interested because I am reading it. But it is interesting that he has got the ideal view of himself, who's an agrarian landholder, self-made man, that he's the pinnacle of his society, which is, what's it, roles in justice? It's interesting. Okay, society and government. According to Jefferson's philosophy, citizens have certain inalienable rights, the right for liberty to be unobstructed action according to our will within limits drawn around us by the equal rights of others. A staunch advocate of the jury system to protect people's liberty, he proclaimed in 1801, "I consider trial by jury the only anchor yet imagined by man by which government can held to be principles of its constitution." Jefferson's government not only prohibited individuals in society from infringing the liberties of others, but also restrained itself from diminishing individual liberty as a protection against the tyranny of the majority. Initially, Jefferson favoured restricted voting to those who could actually have free exercise of their reason by escaping any corrupting dependence on others. He advocated enfranchising the majority of Virginians, seeking to expand the suffrage to include yeoman farmers who owned their own land, while excluding tenant farmers, city labourers, vagrants, and most American Indians and women. He was convinced that individual liberties were the fruit of political equality, which were threatened by arbitrary government. Excess of democracy, in his view, were caused by institutional corruptions rather than human nature. Who is less suspicious of working democracy than many contemporaries. As president, Jefferson feared that the federalist system enacted by Washington and Adams encouraged corrupting patronage and dependence. He tried to restore the balance between state and federal governments, more nearly reflecting the Articles of Confederation, seeking to reinforce the prerogatives where his party was in majorities. What I do actually do agree that... what we see today is mass corruption. Just mass corruption. So it is true. Jefferson was steeped in the British Whig tradition of the oppressed majority set against a repeatedly unresponsive court party in the Parliament. He justified small outbreaks of rebellion as necessary to get monarchical regimes to amend oppressive measures compromising popular liberties. In a Republican regime ruled by the majority, he acknowledged it will often be exercised when wrong, but the remedy is to set them right as to the facts, pardon them and pacify them. As Jefferson saw his party triumph in two terms of his presidency and launch in a third term under James Madison. His view of the U.S. as a commercial republic and an empire of liberty grew more upbeat. On departing his presidency in 1809, he described America as trusted with the destinies of a solitary republic in the world, the only monument to human rights and the sole repository of the sacrificed freedom of self-government. That's a bit, so that's insane. Thank you, very insulting. With the Burr conspiracy is just mind-blowing. Democracy. Jefferson considered democracy to be expression of society and promoted national self-determination, cultural uniformity, and education for all males of the Commonwealth. There you go. He supported a republic education as a free press as essential components of a democratic nation. After resigning Secretary of State in 1795, Jefferson focused on the electoral basis of the Republican and the Federalists. The Republican classification for which he advocated included the entire body of land, however, the body of labor is without land. Republicans united behind Jefferson as vice president with the election in 1796, expanding democracy nationwide at grassroots levels. Jefferson's promoted Republican candidates for local offices. Beginning in Jefferson's electioneering for the Revolution of 1800, his political efforts were based on egalitarian appeals. His later years, he referred to the 1800 election as a real revolution in principles of our government, as it was in the 76, as it was in its form. One not affected by the sword, but by the suffrage of the people. Voters, participants grew the Jefferson presidency. Now listen to this. Increasing to unimaginable levels compared to the Federalist era. The turnout was 67,000 in 1800. 67,000. So we would be embarrassed in Australia if we had been rising to 143,000 in 1804. On the onset of the Revolution, Jefferson accepted William Blackstone's argument that property ownership would sufficiently empower voters' independent judgment, but he sought to further expand suffrage to land distribution to the poor. In the heat of the Revolution era and afterwards, several slave states expanded their voters' eligibility from landed gentry to all property male tax-paying citizens, which Jefferson supported. In his retirement, he gradually became critical of his home state for violating the principle of equal political rights. The social right to universal male suffrage he sought, a general suffrage for all taxpayers, militiamen, and equal representation by population in the General Assembly to correct preferential treatment of the slaveholding regions. You can see the ballot was because there was not universal suffrage. Obviously, the now you've got universal suffrage. The American ballot system is no longer any good. Now, there's no way that I can tell that this page should start off with slavery or religion. Banks. Guess what? It has to go this way. Religion. Baptized in his youth, Jefferson became a governing member of the local Episcopal Church in Charlottesville, which he later attended with his daughters, influenced because his sons died. Influenced by the deist authors during his college years, Jefferson abandoned Orthodox Christianity with a view of the New Testament teaching. In 1803, he asserted, "I am a Christian in the only sense which Jesus wished anyone to be." Jefferson later defined Christian as anyone who followed the simple teaching of Jesus. Jefferson compiled Jesus' biblical teachings, omitting miraculous and supernatural references. He entitled the work The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, known today as the Jefferson Bible. Peterson states Jefferson was a theist whose God was the creator of the universe, and all evidence of nature testified to his perfection, and a man could only rely on the harmony and benefits of his work. Isn't that amazing? Jefferson was firmly anti-clerical, writing In every age, the priest has been hostile to liberal. They have perverted the purest religion ever preached to man into the mystery and jargon. In full letters to Horatio Splatford, it can be read in the National Archives. Jefferson once supported banning clergy from public office, but later resented. In 1777, he drafted the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. Ratified in 1786, it made compelling attendance or contributions to any state-sanctioned religion establishment illegal and declared that men shall be free to profess their opinions on matters of religion. This statute is one of the only three accomplishments he chose to have inscribed in his epitaph on the gravestone. Early in 1802, Jefferson wrote the Danbury, Connecticut Baptist Association that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God. He interpreted this First Amendment as being built a wall of separation between church and state. The phrase separation of church and state has been cited several times by the Supreme Court in the interpretation of the Establishment Clause. Of course, it's, I think, Diocletian, the Roman Emperor, got this in the act, getting the separation of power. Jefferson donated the American Bible Society, saying that the four evangelists delivered a pure, a sublime, simple system of morality to humanity. He thought the Americans would rationally create a Aparian religion, extracting the best traditions of every denomination. He contributed generously to several local denominations near Monticello, acknowledging organized religion would always be factored into political life and goodwill, good or ill. He encouraged reason over supernatural revelation to make inquiries into religion. He believed the creator God, so it's bloody well blowing a gale here, and the afterlife, the sum of religion as loving God and neighbours. It's obviously had a few people to speak to. But he also controversially renounced the conventional Christian Trinity denying Jesus' divinity as the Son of God, which you pick up if you read what Philo came up. Jefferson distrusted government banks and opposed public borrowing, which he thought created long-term debt, bred monopolies, invited dangerous speculation as opposed to productive labour. In one letter to Madison, he argued each generation should curtail all debt within 19 years and not impose a long-term debt on subsequent generations. Well, in 1791, President Washington asked Jefferson, then Secretary of State, and Hamilton, the Secretary of the Treasury, if Congress had the authority to create a national bank. While Hamilton believed Congress had the authority, Jefferson and Madison thought the national bank would ignore the needs of the individuals and farmers and violate the 10th Amendment by assuming powers not granted to the federal government by the states. Jefferson used agrarian resistance to banks and speculators as the first defining principle of an opposition party recruiting candidates for Congress on the issue as early as 1792. As president, Jefferson was persuaded by the Secretary of Treasury, Albert Gallatin, to leave the bank intact, but sought to restrain its influence. Slavery. Well, there you go. Jefferson lived as a planter economy largely dependent upon slavery, and as a wealthy landholder, used slave labour to hold for his household, plantation, and workshops. His first recorded slaveholding was in 1774, when he counted 41. Over his lifetime, he owned 600 slaves and inherited 175, while most of the remainder were born in his plantation. Jefferson purchased slaves in order to unite their families. He sold about 110 for economic reasons, primarily slaves from his outlying farms. Many historians have described Jefferson as a benevolent slave owner who didn't overwork his slaves by the conventions of his time, and provided them with log cabins, fireplaces, food, clothing, and some household provisions. The slaves often had to make many of their own provisions. Additionally, Jefferson gave his slaves financial and other incentives while also allowing them to grow gardens and raise their own chickens. The whip was employed only in the rare extreme cases of fighting and stealing. God, far out. Jefferson once said, "My first wish is that the laborers may be well treated." Jefferson did not work his slaves on Sundays and Christmas, as he allowed them more personal time during the winter months. Some scholars doubt Jefferson's benevolence, however, noting cases of excessive slave whippings in his absence. His nail factory was only staffed by child slaves, but many of those boys became tradesmen. Burwell Colbert, who started his working life as a child bottle nailery, was later promoted to supervising a position of butler. Well, there we got the nailery, a nail factory. Jefferson felt slavery was harmful to both the slave and master, but had reservations about releasing unprepared slaves to freedom and advocated gradual emancipation. In 1779, he proposed gradual voluntary training and resettlement to the Virginia legislature, and 3 years later drafted legislation allowing owners to free their own slaves. In his draft of the Declaration of Independence, he included a section stricken from the Southern by other Southern Democrats, criticising George III's role in promoting slavery in the colonies. Oh, there you go. So the British were into slavery. In 1784, Jefferson opposed the abolition of slavery in all proposed Western territories, limiting slave importation to 15 colonies. In 1784, Jefferson, Congress, however, failed to pass the proposal by one vote. In 1787, Congress passed the Northwest Ordinance, a partial victory for Jefferson that terminated slavery in the Northwest Territory. Jefferson freed his slave Robert Hemings in 1794, and he freed his cook slave James Hemings, or I think in 1796. Now, it's really interesting that this entire slavery, so it's the Hemings. It's, you can hear how bloody windy it is at the moment. Come on. During its presidency, Jefferson allowed the diffusion of slavery into Louisiana Territory, hoping to prevent slave uprising in Virginia and prevent South Carolina's secession. In 1804, the compromise on slavery issue, Jefferson and Congress banned domestic slave trafficking for 1 year in Louisiana Territory. In 1806, he officially called the anti-slavery legislation terminating the import and export of slaves. Congress passed the law in 1807, taking effect in 1818. In 1819, he strongly opposed Missouri statehood application amendment that banned domestic slave importation and freed slaves at the age of 25 on the grounds it would destroy the Union. Jefferson freed his runaway slave Harriet Hemings in 1822. Upon his death in 26, Jefferson freed five male Hemings slaves in his will. What I rather like is that they may not be all from the same Hemings. They were probably bought by someone called Hemings. He probably, because the slaves, their surname was the surname of the actual person who first owned them. Jefferson shared the common belief of his day that blacks were mentally and physically inferior, but argued that they nonetheless had innate human rights. In the Notes of the States of Virginia, he created controversy by calling slavery a moral evil for which the nation would ultimately have to account to God. He therefore supported colonization plans that would transport free slaves to another country, such as Liberia, Sierra Leone, though he recognized this impracticality of these proposals. During his presidency, Jefferson was, for the most part, publicly silent on the issue of slavery and emancipation. As the congressional debate over slavery and extension caused dangerous North-South rift amongst the states, with talk of the Northern Confederacy of the New England, the violent attacks on white slave owners during the Haitian Revolution due to injustices under slavery supported Jefferson's fear of a race war, increasing his reservations about promoting emancipation at that time. After numerous attempts and failures to bring about emancipation, Jefferson wrote privately in 1805 a letter to William E. Burrell, quote, "I've long since given up the expectation of any early provision for the extinguishment of slavery among us," end quote. The same year he also related the idea of George Lodigan writing, quote, "I have carefully avoided every public act or manifestation on that subject." Historical assessment. Scholars remain divided on whether Jefferson truly condemned slavery and how he changed. Francis D. Collingham traces the development of competing emancipation, and then revisionist, and finally contextualist interpretations of the 1960s to the present. The emancipist view held the various scholars of Thomas Jefferson Foundation, Douglas I. Wilson and others maintained Jefferson was an opponent of slavery all his life, noting he did what he could within limited range of his options available to him to undermine it. His many attempts at the abolition legislation and the manner in which he provided for slaves and his advocacy of the more humane treatment. The revisionist view advanced by Paul Finkelman and others criticizes Jefferson for racism for... Oh, there you go. For holding slaves and for acting contrary to his words. Jefferson never freed most of his slaves, and he remained silent on the issue while he was president. Contextualists such as Joseph J. Ellis emphasized a change in Jefferson's thinking from the emancipation views before 1783, noting Jefferson's shift towards public passivity and pacification and policy issues related to slavery. Jefferson seemed to yield to public opinion in 1794 as he laid the groundwork for the first presidential campaign against Adams in 1796. Jefferson-Hemings controversy. Claims that Jefferson fathered Sally Hemings' children have been debated since 1802. That year, James D. Chandler, after being denied a position as postmaster, Jefferson had taken Hemings as a concubine and fathered several children with him. In 1998, a panel of researchers conducted Y-DNA studies of living descendants of the Jefferson uncle, Feared, and descendants of the Hemingson son, Eston Hemings. Result published in the Journal of Nature showed a match to the male Jefferson Lyme. Well, there you go. In 2000, the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, the TJF, assembled a team of historians whose report concluded the DNA study indicates a high probability that Thomas Jefferson fathers Eston Hemings. In July 2017, Thomas Jefferson Foundation announced that an archaeological excavation of Monticello had revealed what they believed to be Sally Hemings' quarters adjacent to Jefferson's bedroom. The Thomas Jefferson Foundation stated in 2018 it considered the issue a settled historical matter. Since the results of the DNA test were made public, the consensus amongst academic historians has been that Jefferson had a sexual relationship with Sally Hemings and that he was father of his son, Eston Hemings, though some experts dispute these conclusions. Some scholars maintain the evidence is insufficient to prove Jefferson's paternity conclusively. Based on DNA and other evidence, they note possibility that the additional Jefferson males, including the brother Rudolph Jefferson and any one of Randolph's four sons of his cousins could have fathered Heston Jennings and Sally's children. Oh my god, what do you want? There you go. I don't know what to try. So she had a quarter next, she slept in the room next to his bedroom. How'd he go? Jefferson was a farmer obsessed with new crops, soil conditions, garden designs, and scientific agricultural techniques. His main cash crop was tobacco. Good on you. But its price was usually low and was rarely profitable. He tried to achieve self-sufficiency with wheat, vegetable, flax, corn, hogs, sheep, poultry, cattle. It does apply as family, slaves, employees, but he lived perpetually beyond his means and was always in debt. In the field of architecture, Jefferson helped popularize the neo-Palladian style of the United States, utilizing designs of the Virginia State Capitol, University of Virginia, Monticello, and others. Jefferson, basically, it's the same design over and over again. Jefferson marketed architecture through self-study, using various books and classical architectural designs of the day. His primary authority was Andrea Palladio's. Oh, that's what the Palladian sign is. That, what is it? Oh yeah, so Andrea Palladian, the four books of architecture, which outlines the principle of classical designs. He was interested in birds and wines and noted gourmet. He was also a prolific writer and linguist and spoke several languages. As a naturalist, he was fascinated by the natural bridge geological formation and in 1774 successfully acquired the bridge by grant from George III. Whatever does that mean? What does the natural bridge mean? American Philosophical Society. Jefferson was a member of the American Philosophical Society for 35 years, beginning in 1780. Through the society, advanced the science of the Enlightenment ideals, emphasizing knowledge and science reinforced by extended freedom. His Notes on the State of Virginia was written in part as a contribution to the society. He became the society's third president on March 3, 1797, a few months after he was elected vice president of the United States. In accepting, Jefferson stated, quote, "I feel no qualification for this distinguished post, but a sincere zeal for all the objects of our institution, and the ardent desire to see knowledge being disseminated through mass mankind at length and reach the extreme societies, beggars, and kings." Jefferson served the APS president for the next 18 years, including through both terms of his presidency. He introduced Meriwether Lewis to the society, where various scientists tutored him in the preparation of the Lewis-Clark expedition. He resigned on January 20, 1815, but remained active through correspondence. Jefferson had a lifelong interest in linguistics and could speak, read, write a number of languages, including French, Greek, Italian, and German. His early years, he excelled at classical languages while at boarding school, where he received a classical education in Greek and Latin. I don't know how you do it. Far out. Latin is just so complex. How could you... I don't know how they do this. Jefferson later became to regard Greek language as the perfect language as expressed in the Laws of Philosophy. While attending George, William and Mary, he taught himself Italian. Here, Jefferson became familiar with the Anglo-Saxon language, especially as it was associated with the English common law and the system of government, and studied the language in linguistic philosophical capacity. He owned 17 volumes of the Anglo-Saxon text and grammar, and later wrote an essay on the Anglo-Saxon language. Jefferson claimed to have taught himself Spanish during the 19-day journey to France, using only grammar guide and a copy of Don Quixote. I don't believe this. Linguistics played a significant role in how Jefferson modelled and expressed political philosophical ideas. He believed the study of ancient language was essential to understanding the roots of modern language, I agree. He collected and understood a number of American Indian vocabularies and instructed Lewis and Clark to record and collect various Indian languages during the expedition. When Jefferson removed from Washington after the presidency, he packed 50 Native American vocabulary lists in his chest and transported them on a riverboat back to Monticello along the rest of his position. Somewhere along the journey, a thief stole the heavy chest, thinking it was full of valuables. But its contents were dumped into the James River when the thief discovered it was only filled with paper. Subsequently, 30 years of collecting were lost, with only a few fragments rescued from the muddy banks of the river. Isn't that absolutely amazing? Jefferson was not an outstanding orator and preferred to communicate through writing and remained silent if possible. G'day, guys. Instead of delivering his State of the Union address himself, Jefferson wrote the annual messages and sent the representatives to read them aloud in Congress. G'day, guys. This started the tradition which continued to 1913 when President Woodrow Wilson chose to deliver his own State of the Union address. Jefferson's invention. Jefferson invented many small practical devices that improved contemporary inventions, including a revolving book stand, the great clock, powered by gravitational pull of cannonballs. He improved the pedometer, telegraphy, a device for duplicating writing, a mould board plough, an idea never patented and gave to posterity. Jefferson also credited as creator of the swivel chair, the first of which was created and used to write much of the Declaration of Independence. Isn't that great? It's just great. As Minister of France, Jefferson was impressed by the military standardization program and his assistant Gravel initiated a program with the president to develop interchangeable parts of firearms. His inventiveness and ingenuity received several honorary doctors and law degrees. Now, I think I will just see how we get to go. I've got a little bit. I may as well just crash through. Legacy. Historical reputation. Jefferson is an icon of individual liberty, democracy, republicanism, hailed as the author of the Declaration of Independence, an architect through the American Revolution, in a Renaissance man who promoted science and scholarship. the participatory democracy and expanded suffrage he championed to find in his era and became a standard for later generations. Meakin opined that Jefferson was the most influential figure in the Democratic Republic of the first half century, succeeded by presidential adherents James Madison, James Monroe, Andrew Jackson, Martin Van Buren. Jefferson is recognized having written more than 18,000 letters of political and philosophical substance during his life, which Francis D. Collinger describes as a documentary legacy unprecedented in American history in size and breadth. Jefferson's reputation declined in the American Civil War due to his support of the states' rights, and in late 19th century, his legacy was widely criticized. Conservatives felt that his democratic philosophy had led to an era of populist movements, while progressives sought a more activist federal government. Jefferson's philosophy allowed both groups saw Alexander Hamilton as vindicated by history rather than Jefferson, and President Woodrow Wilson even described Jefferson as, though a great man, not a great American. In 1930s, Jefferson was held in high esteem. Franklin D. Roosevelt, 35-45, the New Deal Democrats celebrated his struggles for the common man and acclaimed him for their party's founder. Jefferson became the symbol of American democracy in the incipient Cold War, and the 1940s, 50s saw the zenith of his popular reputation following the civil rights movement of... '50s and '60s. Jefferson's slaveholding became under new scrutiny, particularly after DNA testing in the late 90s supported allegations of his relationship with Sally Hemings. Noting a huge output of scholarly books, Jefferson in recent years, historian Gordon Wood summarised the raging debates about Jefferson's stature. Although many historians and others are embarrassed by his contradictions and have thought to knock him off the Democratic pedestal, his position, though shaky, still seems secure. The Siena Research Poll of presidential scholars began in 1982 has consistently ranked Jefferson as one of the five best U.S. presidents, and 2015 Booking Institute Poll of American Political Science Association members ranking him as the fifth greatest president. Memorial and Honors. Jefferson has been memorialized in building sculptures, post-stamps currency. 1920s Jefferson, together with George Washington, Theodore Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln, was chosen by the sculptor Gaston Bourgoin and approved by President Calvin Coolidge to be depicted on the stones of Mount Rushmore Memorial. Isn't that amazing? Jefferson Memorial was dedicated in Washington in 1943 on the 200th anniversary of Jefferson's birth. The interior memorial includes a 19-foot statue of Jefferson and engraving passages of his writing. Most prominent of the words described around the monument near the roof is, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against everyone, every form of tyranny over the mind of man." Isn't that great? That's the end of Thomas Jefferson. So, well, Sally Hemings is something which is just really revealed. It's lovely how it was revealed in little bits and pieces through this thing, and the DNA evidence came at the end. It's pretty hard to do it. It's sort of, yeah, what a contradiction. Very interesting man.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.